Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I am joined by Mr. Marius Rutte, the greatest son of Benoni, or Boxburg, or wherever it is you come from, Marius. Marius, which part is it? I always forget.
It's Benoni. Right? It's very insulting to say to somebody from Benoni that they're from Boxburg. So I'll just
at least I didn't say you were from Springs.
It's like saying to somebody, where are you from, that you're actually from Randburg or something. I don't know. Or Rudapert.
I'm not so... it's all the same to me. And today, I'm also joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan, that son of Dundee. Is that where you were born, Terence? I think so, because you're from KZN originally.
From the independent kingdom of KwaZulu-Natal. You know, that's what you say. You bet, independent kingdom of KwaZulu-Natal. Now under uncertain management.
Indeed.
Like the country.
But you are two-thirds of the rain in the country, so, you know, suck it up, guys.
That's some good KZN nationalism coming through. Right, let us get deep into the weeds today, and we are going to be talking about something that I personally despise. I don't know if all of my arguments against it are particularly coherent, logical, or well-reasoned, but I'll lay it out, and so you can judge for yourself. The sugar tax. Now, many South Africans, I think, are probably familiar with the fact that a couple of years ago, the government implemented a sugar tax, which was aimed at primarily reducing the amount of sugary drinks that were consumed by South Africans. And the hope was that this would reduce the amount of type 2 diabetes and obesity in the South African population, which is actually surprisingly high for a country that is as poor as ours. South Africa has this weird thing of that we have quite a few people who are malnourished and actually, you know, close to starvation. And we also have people who are horrifically obese, who are only slightly richer than the starving people. Anyway, that's maybe a topic we can get into later. But proper sort of scientific evaluation of the effect of the sugar tax has been published a little bit earlier this year, and its authors say that South Africans are buying 28% less sugary drinks, and as a result, they say they have markedly reduced their sugar and calorie intake. This, although they go on to say that while there does appear to be some reduction in the amount of sugary drinks purchased, they cannot say whether this is actually going to have any sort of effect on obesity and diabetes rates, which, of course, are a big problem, particularly when you have, you know, diseases like COVID running around, which make those things worse. One of the interesting things that is in this news article I'm reading about this report is that poorer households tend to purchase far more sugary drinks than wealthier households. And it's kind of interesting to me that the sugar tax was passed without much attention to this fact, when it is effectively a tax targeted at poor people. And to me, it's always rubbed me up the wrong way, because it comes off with an extremely sort of condescending view of how people should live their lives. If you are poor and you really can't afford that many nice things, you know, can't you at least be allowed to buy sugary drinks? It's better than booze. I don't know. Marius, what do you make of the sugar tax? What do you make of its effects? Do you think it is actually going to have any real effects on our health system and our obesity rates? And am I just being a silly liberty-obsessed moron when I say that it's condescending?
Well, it does seem, from that article, does seem it has had some effect on people buying less sugary drinks and so on. But I think when it comes to these kind of public health interventions, you need a whole bunch of things working together. You can't just have, for example, the sugar tax and whatever. And as you say, it does seem to be a bit of a tax on the poor. I've definitely seen, I've read studies abroad and so on, where it's quite expensive to actually eat healthily. You know, to eat healthy food, or, you know, whatever you call it, organic food and stuff, is often quite expensive to, you know, kind of processed foods and compared to a lot of types of takeaways and stuff. So especially in the West or in, you know, more developed places, it's, you know, food that's worse for you is obviously a lot, is often a lot cheaper than, you know, food that these, whatever you want to call them, I don't know, yuppies or whatever want to eat. So, but yeah, it does seem to be a bit of a, you know, it is a kind of condescending, but at the same time, we have a lot of, there are lots of ways that the government does try to encourage people not to do things that are bad for them. We have the various sin taxes. So, you know, a lot of the money that you pay for a bottle of whiskey or whatever is, you know, just goes in tax, and it's raised to ensure, to try and make people drink less alcohol, because we do know alcohol can be pretty bad for you, same as tobacco and all kinds of things. So
I will say that to me, the slight difference there is that when you drink a can of Coke, you're not more likely to stab someone in a bar.
Yeah, but I suppose, I mean, it's all about, you know, different interventions for public health. And, you know, it also depends what is actually happening with the money that comes from the sugar tax. So I remember a couple of years ago, we had the plastic bag that was basically a tax. You had to pay 5 cents or 10 cents or whatever the case is to, you know, get a plastic bag in a shop that previously was free. And this money was going to be ring fenced and used to, you know, recycle plastic and all kinds of things. But you can still get plastic bags in shops. People are happy to pay the 20 cents or 50 cents or whatever it is, you know. So, I mean, maybe the way to do it is what I know Woolworths does now, where you have to buy one of those, you know, it's kind of a linen bag or whatever the case is. And every time I go to Woolworths, I definitely forget my, you know, that bag. So I either have to, sometimes when I'm too stingy, then I have to carry like 12 items in my hands if I don't want to buy a bag or whatever the case is. So, yeah, I'm not completely opposed to it, but it is kind of condescending. As you said, it does sometimes feel as if certain people are being targeted.
So one of the, I think, the strongest arguments for interventions like the sugar tax is that we, of course, have a large public health system, which is very important for many South Africans who can't access private healthcare. And the moment that you have a system which has limited resources, which is funded by taxpayers, and which is free, you create a situation where it makes a lot of sense for the government to start policing how you live your life, how you police your body, what you eat, that kind of thing. And this is one of the reasons why I've always been a bit nervous about the importance of public health systems in various in any country where they take root. Because I think that it does open the door to an enormous amount of intrusion on your private life. The character from the TV show Parks and Rec is one of my favorite lines on this topic, which is, he says, the great thing about America is you can eat garbage, balloon up to 600 pounds and die at 42. And that's beautiful. Terrence, what do you make of this? What do you make of the sugar tax itself? And yeah, this kind of intervention in general.
I just want to say, like, does the shirt make me look fat? And some people would say, no, it's not the shirt. You know, when this was under consideration, I had exactly that conversation with a lady whom I have the utmost respect, who was involved with an NGO that was enthusiastically in favor of it. And I said, look, you know, I imagine that you know, if you raise the cost on anything, you are likely to see some consumer response, unless it was a particularly habit forming or absolutely essential product. But I said, you know, it does rather concern me that in your house or in mine, we'll just carry on and we'll suck up the extra, you know, 1 rand or 2 rand or whatever. For somebody whose only sort of joy in the morning after waking up in his shack is, you know, to put a bit of sugar in his black tea, that, you know, that looks very different. I haven't looked at the details of the study, and I think that's something that we ought to do. Is the decline in purchasing these drinks entirely driven by the tax or by the general economic downturn, for instance?
So we know one of the data points used in the study suggested that the amount of fruit juice purchased had not gone down by that much, and so they claimed that this was evidence that it was sugary drinks specifically that were falling. Although I must say I'm a little bit skeptical, as you were saying. Sorry to interrupt.
You know, there. I don't know. I'm spitballing and speculating here, but for households that cut their expenditure on these sort of things, I wonder if a fizzy drink is not seen as a kind of luxury, whereas a fruit juice is seen as a type of nutritional food. You know, I have some experience with diabetes, and it's amazing how many well-meaning, you know, lay people will say things like, "Oh, don't worry, we won't serve sweets, but you know, we'll give some fruit juice." Actually, both contain sugar, and therefore both are unsuitable. But you know, there's this assumption that you know, fruit juice is the healthy option. So you know, I think what you're dealing with here really is a kind of sledgehammer myth. Bless you. Is a kind of sledgehammer approach. Will this affect things in the longer term? Well, there's a great deal of moving parts to any system like that, and you know, one has to wait and see over time. But I don't think that we should easily concede the autonomy principle, that if one chooses to live a life that is not healthy, that may not be something that society should glory in. It may not be something that the government wants. To what extent? But I think that there is a legitimate point to saying that you know, it's my body, and that is not something for nationalization.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that as with most social science studies, there's, you know, you have to dig around a lot in data before you can come to any sort of conclusion. And even then, it's always going to be a little bit shaky because, as you say, there's so many moving parts in a complex system like this, you know, what makes people unhealthy. I see someone in the comments is suggesting that education level is a way of solving some of these problems. But I'd venture that perhaps even more important than that is people's level of wealth in general. If you're much wealthier, you can afford things like gym memberships, you can afford things like healthier diet foods and that kind of stuff. You don't have to buy sort of cheap white bread or rely on sugary drinks as your sort of relaxing luxury good that you invest your extra
money. Can I just quickly make a point? I mean, the three of us are all probably what you'd say is solidly middle class, but do any of us go to the gym and do any of us buy very healthy food?
No, sure, but it's
I watch half an hour of gym on TV every day. So.
My corpulent figure is entirely by choice, not by circumstance.
Maybe eat garbage, etc., etc. Careful, 42 is coming.
So yeah, the point is that it at least gives, you know, if people are wealthier in general, it gives them opportunities. And I think you can see this in other countries. I know the US is a country that's for a long time had very big obesity problems, despite being quite wealthy. Although I think I'm correct in saying that obesity rates have actually fallen a bit there, and they've been overtaken as the world's most obese country by, I think it's Mexico. And part of that is due to the fact that Americans have begun to invest more in, you know, healthier foods and exercise and that kind of stuff.
Anyway. You know, on that, about 15 years ago, I think National Geographic did a big special on obesity, and it showed how, while America was in the lead, other developed countries were coming up fast behind them. You know, even Germany, Canada, are countries that you associate with more healthy lifestyles, and also developing world countries. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the fact that for the last century or so, we've had something that has been quite new in the human experience, which is abundant food. Right. You know, you can imagine, you know, growing up in the 19th century, odds are you're probably a small farmer or something, or you know, an industrial worker working a 12, 13 hour day. You worked hell of hard for very little, and you know, that took care of your weight problem, and you know, you're much more likely to have not enough to eat than too much. Now we kind of have the reverse.
Indeed. Any final thoughts, Marius, before we move on?
No, I think as all well, what the one point is, apparently we do crave certain things in junk food, which a couple of, you know, when we were cavemen or whatever, was very hard to get. That's why we crave them, but now they've abundantly available, and that is why people eat, you know, we do need a certain amount of fat in our diet, but now it's very readily available. People eat far too much of it, for example, or sugar itself. You need sugar in your diet, but now people are so readily available, people eat it too much, even though our bodies still crave it.
All right, let us move on to our next topic today. And of course, we did mention this last week, but the results have come in, and this is the election in Canada, which quite honestly is kind of a bit of a damn squib as far as news goes. So the results are not all in yet, so we don't know the final shakedown of who exactly is going to gain what. But previously, Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party was the leading political party in Canada. They did not have a majority in Parliament, but they were the largest in terms of number of seats, and they were in sort of a kind of a coalition with the left-wing New Democratic Party. So Justin Trudeau, in an attempt to boost his seats in Parliament to perhaps gain an absolute majority, called an election, hoping that his response to COVID would push him into the lead. And he faced a very much more difficult campaign than he was expecting. There was a challenge from the sort of libertarian-leaning People's Party. There was a very centrist push from the Canadian Conservatives, led by a guy called O'Toole, which I think is an unfortunate name for a politician. And, of course, the Quebec separatists, who are the other important party in Canada. And with the results coming in now, it looks like pretty much exactly everything is staying as it was. The Liberals have not managed to gain the majority of votes. However, they are going to still be the largest party in Parliament with about 32% of the vote and around 158 seats. They need 170 to form a majority. The Conservatives will be on 119 seats. The Separatists, the Quebec Separatists on 34, and the New Democrats on 25. With the People's Party, the Libertarians, getting about 5% of the vote, but no seats. So, Maurice, let's start with you. What do you make of this? I must say, I'm somewhat surprised. I thought that Trudeau would do worse than this, but he also didn't do great. What's your view?
I think he thought, you know, people would reward him for what he would have considered a fairly well-handled, you know, crisis with regard to COVID and so on. And perhaps that is actually what kind of helped him. Maybe people who would have maybe wanted to give somebody like Erin O'Toole, the leader of the Conservatives, a go, or, you know, maybe even give their vote to the New Democratic Party, the left-leaning guys, decided in the interest of continuity maybe to stick to Trudeau. Because, I mean, this is basically a cut and paste of the last election. It's, you know, one or two seats have changed hands, but nothing really that much different. The only thing that's kind of interesting is that this People's Party, the Libertarians, went from about 1% of the vote to 5% of the vote, but they're not going to get into Parliament. So, and also the New Democratic guys, they also, you know, I think they've gained one seat. So they've gone from 24 seats to 25 seats in Parliament. So it's all going to be pretty much status quo. Nothing much is going to change. And it's clear that Canadians don't mind it if their leader dresses up in a bit of blackface. It's obviously not they're not too against it. But I think one thing that's quite interesting now, this is the second election in a row that the Conservatives actually won more votes than the Liberals, but the Liberals are going to be the biggest party. And there is actually a bit of a push for electoral reform in Canada. You know, it also it harms the smaller parties, the New Democrats, the Greens, this New People's Party. So there's definitely a push for electoral reform in Canada, and people have been saying they should either use the system used in New Zealand, the mixed member system, which we also use at local government level here, or the single transferable votes, which is it's kind of complicated, so we don't need to go into jail. So, I mean, I think that was the
people I think for what it's worth, I think single transferable vote systems, STVs, are terrible just because people mess them up all the time and no one knows how they work.
Now, I've tried to read about it a million times and I'm still not too sure I understand how it works. So, but yeah, I mean, nothing's really changed. It's pretty much status quo. Trudeau's going to, you know, bumble along till 2023 most likely. So, yeah, it's nothing's it was pretty, you know, Canada's pretty much is quite a boring place, and I think this election kind of underscores it.
Right, so the reason I said that I didn't think Trudeau would do very well is he's had a couple of brushes with corruption scandals. I think he appointed one of the first Native Americans to a high office in Canada and then fired them, allegedly, for looking into corruption. He, of course, also had, I think, three photos of him in silly costumes, basically doing blackface, came out during over the past couple of years. And that seems to have hurt him, but yeah, it wasn't enough to topple him. And on top of that, you know, I think that his policies haven't been great for Canada either, but that's neither here nor there. Because it's often the sort of non-political scandals that will really take down a government. And Trudeau certainly had those, but he seems to have managed to scrape by. But Terence, one of the things that, as far as I understand from, I've got some friends in Canada and they told me a little bit about the campaign, is that the Liberals in Canada's campaign strategy was very much to tie the Conservatives in Canada to Trump in America. And so once again, we're seeing this phenomenon of countries around the world importing American political paradigms and sort of crudely stapling them onto their own local politics. I think the Canadian Conservatives very aggressively rejected this label, particularly because O'Toole was an extremely centrist candidate. So I don't think it was fair at all, but what do you make of that, and what do you make of Trudeau?
Well, I'd like to start off with something more instead of Canada being a boring country. Oh, to live in a boring country. That's like, you know, a true marvel of history.
You'd rather live in Norway than Afghanistan, eh?
Well, yeah, no, there's never a dull moment in Afghanistan. I think that sort of comparison is inaccurate and contemptible. In fact, someone put something on Twitter. Yeah, I know. I'm not on Twitter, but I was alerted to this. Showing that at the time that Prime Minister Trudeau was dressed up as the genie of the lamp with shoe polish, Erin O'Toole was serving as a helicopter pilot in the Canadian Army. You know, if it wants to look back at records, you know, I wouldn't put my money on Mr. Trudeau. But yeah, my understanding is that Canada, perhaps because of its proximity to America, and also I think because of its particular ethnic split, gets kind of a lot of sort of secondhand American cultural influence, possibly more powerfully than exists elsewhere in the world. I'll give you an example. When George W. Bush was president, actually shortly after after America went into Afghanistan, I heard about a crowd in Quebec that booed the Canadian, I think the American ice hockey team. And I was living in Taiwan, and I spoke to a guy. A guy from Canada, a sort of middle-class chap from Edmonton. And he said, yeah, okay, that's Quebec. That wouldn't happen in Ontario. And also, you know, speaking to a few other people around the time, you know, who would never refer to George Bush without putting the F word in front of him, it would say something, yeah, but my dad thinks he's great. So, you know, while I don't think that comparison actually holds any empirical truth, it probably has a certain emotional reach. I mean, it's the same thing of you know, some of our critics who can't pen a coherent critique without somehow referring to Donald Trump. To which I respond, well, you know, the one thing Donald Trump was very strong on was immigration, and we were actually very much in favor of immigration. So I don't know, but you know, it's not dealing with facts. It's dealing with this mush of emotion. And yeah, I think all of us, as I've said before, live in two worlds. One is the actual world of our daily experience, and other is a simulacrum which looks very much like America because of the influence of American TV and movies and whatever. And we all know America is sort of a land of, you know, absolutely flawless landscapes and, you know, blonde women in bikinis, etc., and car chases on every corner, you know, where people can live lives with boundless free time to pursue personal problems. Probably very unlike what actually happens in America, but you know, that's our sort of Faux reality.
Indeed. If only it were so. I'm fond of America, but if that really was what America was like, I would be desperately trying to cross the border from Mexico at the moment.
Well, apparently that border is already a thing right now, so maybe this is the chance.
Yeah, no, they're having a big issue with a lot of Haitian people are currently on the border there. But I haven't followed the details of that crisis very closely, I must say. Yeah, interesting stuff.
One interesting thing I'd just like to point out with the Canadian elections is that Trudeau got criticized by both O'Toole from the Conservatives and Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the left-wing New Democrats, for not getting involved in AUKUS, this new security alliance. So it's quite interesting that, you know, traditionally left-wing guys are kind of opposed to American multilateralism and so on. So it tells you something that Mr. Singh is criticizing Trudeau for not getting involved in it. So, you know, I think maybe the worries about China is starting to rise around the world.
Yeah, I think because unlike during the Cold War, where I think on the left, on the further left in particular, there was much more sympathy for the Soviets, I think in our emerging Cold War that the far left is actually not quite as keen on China as they were on the Soviets. And so I'm not surprised. In fact, it's another reason why I thought Trudeau wouldn't do that well. So I think he probably has been seen as being soft on China. And Canada has had some pretty tense relations with China recently. They arrested a Huawei executive, and as a result, a bunch of Canadians suddenly were arrested by the Chinese government. And the accusation has been that they are essentially being held hostage by the Chinese government until they release the Huawei executive.
There's a comparable situation in New Zealand, actually, and something that Mrs. Ardern has come in for a lot of criticism, that whereas Australia is taking its security issues there very, very seriously, New Zealand is not. And actually, there was something on Australian TV the other night that they're about to acquire all these nuclear submarines. New Zealand essentially has outsourced its security to America and Australia, but they won't let the protectors actually sail their warships into their waters. So, you know, when the Chinese are, you know, arrive, well, you know, I sort of have to get environmental permission before.
But to be fair to the Kiwis, they haven't allowed that since 1987, I think. New Zealand's been a nuclear-free zone since the mid-80s.
So what you're saying, Morris, is they've been freeloading since the 1980s.
Yes, exactly.
They abolished their Air Force. that's why there's also these Kiwis in the RAF and in the Australian Air Force, because they can't, you know, get a job in their own country.
They just try, I don't know, they put helium balloons on sheep or something. They try to use that as a, you know.
No, they're just hoping it's going to happen in someone else's backyard.
Well, you know, the Canadians have actually done a little bit of the same thing. I believe that South Africa actually has more attack helicopters than the Canadian Air Force, which is quite something when you consider how much wealthier they are than us.
You know, in the 1950s, Canada had the fifth largest surface navy in the world. There was a hangover of World War II and everything, but it was formidable. You know, these days, you actually hear Canadian politicians complaining they can't patrol their own coast. They've got to rely on the American cousins if ever there is an invasion fleet steaming out of, you know, Shanghai.
I think Canada also has the longest coastline in the world, I think, if I'm mistaken, because of all the inlets.
A lot of it is anyway, I don't think we have enough time to cover our final story here, but we weren't super I don't know, attached to it anyway, so I don't think it matters that much.
Canada's exciting.
Yeah, you see, Canada is more exciting than we give it for. Anyway, we'll see what comes of it. Trudeau is going to hang on for another couple of years, and we'll see if that maintains. I'd be very even more surprised than I am now if he manages to hang on for yet another election. But you never know. Right, so please, if you enjoyed the show, please give us a review.
Sorry, Nick, to interrupt. Yeah. I was going to say Halloween's coming up, so it'll be interesting to see what costume Trudeau decides to go with on the 31st of October.
Yeah, I think he's going to...
Let's see if he'll be culturally sensitive for a change. You know.
It'll have to be like a dice or something like that.
Or maybe I'll dress up as the Jagmeet Singh guy. Who knows?
Naughty, naughty.
I wouldn't be terribly surprised. I mean, he's gotten away with it so far, right? Anyway, if you like listening to the show, please leave us a review. If you like watching the show, please comment or subscribe. I'm also going to put a question down in the comments pinned, asking for your thoughts on some of the topics we discussed today. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed. Please support the Institute of Race Relations by going to our website, irr.org.za, clicking the Join Us button, and signing up as a friend of the Institute. We hope that you enjoyed, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.